Paul Sharp, who works at Bondi FM in Australia. Dear Smashy and Nicey, please jump into your proverbial DeLoreans and hopefully enjoy a demo jingle I created to help transport your show back to the poptastic 80s. Here we go.
Oh, dear.
Kermit
and Simon Mayo.
I'm going to give Paul Sharp the gig.
Okay, top of every show.
This is because at the start of last week, I'd found the jams, or I'd been sent the jingle package from Radio 1, kind of 87, 88. And it sounded very LA and very 80s. So that is Bondi FM's Paul Sharp making us a special jingle. I don't see any reason... Why don't we just say, look, we're going to start with that until someone makes something that's better?
I think it's great. Do we have to pay?
I feel as though he's given it to us.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we'll take that as a gift. When you said you found the Jams,
Jams are the company that made all the jingles for most radio stations.
So all your jingles were made by the Jams?
Yeah. The Jams. He says, happy to refine it if you dig the vibe.
I definitely dig the vibe, but how would you possibly refine it?
How do you know if someone digs your vibe?
Because I've just told you.
Does that mean you like it?
Yes.
The vibe is the same as the groove. Are you with the groove?
I don't need that fascist groove thang, but no. I am with the groove.
Is the vibe and the groove the same thing? Do you vibe within the groove or do you groove whilst in the vibe?
I had a friend called John whose perennial question was vibes? And what he meant was, what do you think? So he'd do something, then he'd go, vibes?
That makes no sense at all. That was a very annoying friend.
He was asking you what the vibes were, you know, like Brian Wilson. What's the vibes?
Yeah, if you're Brian Wilson and you're a genius and you've taken an awful lot of hallucinogenic substances, then you can say vibes.
Well,
where did your friend John come from?
He was a trumpet player in Bad Manners.
Okay, in which case he has no excuse, I'm afraid. Absolutely none excuse. Lip up fatty and all that. I rest my case. Later in the show, by the way, Mark is going to be entertaining us, thrilling us indeed, with the vibe and the groove of these films.
Yeah, we have reviews of Hot Milk, which is a question which I know you will ask me at some point, and what does the title mean, and I will struggle to explain it. We have Jurassic World Rebirth, in which the Jurassic World franchise is reborn, and... The Shrouds, with our very special guest.
Who is David Cronenberg, who spoke to you because of various matters. But anyway, so that's the David Cronenberg, the Mr. Cronenberg. He has a vibe, Cronenberg. He has a groove, and Mark will be tending to both. did he enjoy the experience, do you think?
It's a very moving interview. I mean, I found it very moving because I'm a huge David Cronenberg fan, so I found it very emotional speaking to him. So, I think he tolerated my emotion very well.
And in the Vanguardista groove, what are we talking about there?
Two reissues, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, which is an animation classic back in cinemas, and also Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, which is perhaps one of the best-known modern making of documentaries. It is the documentary about the making of Coppola's Apocalypse Now, and it is up there with... Burden of Dreams and Hamster Factor is one of the great modern movie documentaries.
Plus all the other extra groovy and vibey stuff, which you get every Thursday, and the whole back catalogue of grooves is available as well. So you remember last week and the week before, we were talking about, it's so expensive to go to see a film in Milton Keynes with a family.
More expensive than it would be to go to the BFI IMAX.
Ross Fuller says, in response to last week's email concerning a cinema in Milton Keynes doing away with child tickets and charging a staggering £22.50 per person to see How to Train Your Dragon, I would like to give a shout out to my local, the Curzon Community Cinema in Clevedon near Bristol, where two adults and two children cost a rather more reasonable £26. Not only that, the child ticket actually covers anyone under 30.
Wow.
And is a mere £5.50. So this that's very, very interesting. You know, what can you... There are very few benefits to being 29, but if you go to Clevedon and the Curzon Community Cinema, you can get in for £5.50. Granted, says Ross, the screen is smaller than your average 4x9D wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling super mega multiplex screen. But it is more than made up for by the brilliantly restored Art Deco setting, the armchairs and sofas on the balcony, the incredible collection of cameras and projectors on display throughout the building, and knowing you are supporting a building with a very strong claim to being the oldest continually running cinema in the world. I've had the joy of taking my three children there to see films ranging from Dog Man to My Neighbor Totoro, and he has loved it every time. We wouldn't get to do this if it were three times the price. We would just stick to streaming services, and why wouldn't we? Anyway, so that's very reasonable.
And very good.
James in Leeds, you'll guess where this is going. After listening to Daddy Rob's correspondence regarding the eye-watering cost of a trip to his local Megaplex, I felt compelled to give a shout-out to my local independent, who elegantly demonstrated that it is really, really is possible to do things differently. The amazing Hyde Park Picture House in Leeds.
Fantastic.
Run Hyde and Seek, a regular, obviously Hyde, H-Y, a regular strand aimed specifically at families with younger children, in which they show a very tasteful mix of family-friendly films, both classic and modern. Saturday screenings have free crafts beforehand, and Sunday screenings are autism-friendly. Best of all, the majority of screenings are pay what you can, with prices ranging as low as £2.50 and free tickets available on request, no questions asked. Even younger viewers are catered for with regular BYOB, bring your own baby screenings, babies go in free, grown-up tickets are capped at £6.50. The Picture House is a proper cornerstone of the local community, a shifting mix of students, younger professionals and older established families, and is always packed. It goes to show that a model based on warmth, inclusion, accessibility and community building, words that are actually banned in America, one based on maximum extraction of profit. Who'd have thought it? Tinkety-tong, hello to Jason, up and down with all the usual, from James in Leeds. So there are models. I mean, I appreciate the multiplex are based entirely differently and have to make their money entirely differently. But if you are fortunate enough to live either in Clevedon or in Leeds or somewhere else that has a community-minded cinema, then you can go in for 30 quid or so.
Yeah, I mean, two things on that. You may not notice this, but one of the photographs of you and I that regularly gets recycled, if for some reason we turn up in the papers, which obviously isn't that often, but if it does, the picture that they often use is a picture of us that was taken when we were at the Hyde Park, the cinema, the Hyde Park Beach has such a beautiful place. I know this because we look so much younger in the photographs that I don't think I'm even wearing glasses, because we did a couple of events there and it was absolutely lovely. The best ever ticket price bargain that I ever got in my entire life was the Phoenix in East Finchley during half term when I was a school kid. And they did for £1, as it was then, a ticket for the whole week. And every day they showed two films back to back, and it was Ealing comedy. So it'd be like Digital Thunderbolt, Man in the White Suit, Passport to Pimlico. And they did a double bill. And I went every single day for half term, 5 days, saw 10 films for £1.
That's good parenting, that is. For a quid, the kid is safe in the dark.
Absolutely being entertained. Genius. Absolutely. And I remember really clearly this really weird thing happened. I was standing outside the cinema and this old bloke came up to me and he said, what are you going to see? And I said, I'm going to see a man in the white suit. And he said, oh yeah, what certificate is it? And I said, it's a U certificate. And he said, well, you mind your own business then, and walked off.
I mean, Finchley is a weird place.
I never understood the joke.
That story could have gone in many, many different ways. Finally, before some hot milk, Janie in Birchington, how the other half live. We've just booked to see F1 at the lovely Grade 2 listed Carlton Cinema in Westgate-on-Sea down here in East Kent. And it's cost us £14 plus a £5 booking fee, not per person, in total, which leaves a bit of spare cash to head along to Staples Stores Bakery, which easily surpasses Juno, which is my favourite in Denmark, for quality. And yes, I've been to both. By the way, you should try Anderson and Maillard next time you're over there. Okay, that's almost as it says
Anderson and Maillard.
Yes, which is definitely not pronounced that way, I would imagine. But thank you, Janie, for the tip. Correspondence at curbademo.com. Can I say before we proceed?
Yes.
We're recording this on Monday. It's 9:30 at the moment. The temperature in the room that I'm in, you've got air-conditioned Croatian gorgeousness. The heat, I mean, I'm actually in T-shirt and shorts, which I don't normally believe in for broadcasting purposes. wrong. So I've got no shoes and socks on, just shorts and a T-shirt, and it is almost unbearable. So If you could take over just for a while, that would be great. So hot milk, then. That's just what I don't need.
Yes, hot milk, which is a sort of unsettling psychodrama sprinkled with this kind of seething eroticism, but largely undercut or overpowered by a sense of dread and repressed resentment. So it's adapted for a novel by Deborah Levy. I haven't read the book, and that will be important later on. Written and directed by Rebecca Lenkiewicz. I hope that's the correct pronunciation. She was apparently the first living female playwright to have her work produced at the Olivier stage in the National Theatre. As a screenwriter, she's known for co-writing Ida and Disobedience and writing She Said. Now, this is her directing as well. So Fiona Shaw, who I love Fiona Shaw, is Rose, this cantankerous, wheelchair-bound woman with chronic moving pain, non-specific pain that moves around her body. Doctors are at a loss to cure it. And it's kind of hinted at that maybe it's psychosomatic, maybe it's to do with some form of neurosis rather than anything physical. And there are hints of possible trauma in her past or of some kind of unresolved guilt. Emma Mackey is Sophia, who's her daughter, and she's in her 20s. She's an anthropology student. She's meant to be working on a master's, but it doesn't really seem to be going anywhere because she spends most of the time caring for her mother, who bosses her around. They are bound for Spain, where there is a private clinic which might potentially be able to help Rose, although honestly, she doesn't seem to be capable of being helped. When she's in Spain, Sophia meets Ingrid, played by Vicky Creeps, who, of course, most people will remember as being magnificent in Phantom Thread. She's glamorous. She's mysterious. She turns up on a horse. She rocks a headscarf. She's sexually liberated. And an emotional entanglement begins. But the fact is that she is every bit as spiky and as odd and as unstable as Rose. Meanwhile, Rose is being tended to by a doctor, played by Vincent Perez, at an enormous amount of money, who is, you know, he's looking after her, and she says he's really nice. And she says, yeah, you're paying him £25,000. No wonder he's nice. And relationships between everybody grow more and more strained. Here is a clip.
Isn't she lovely? Do you think you'll ever marry Fia? There is a reason why the man is called the groom. It's an ominous title.
Siempre con la misma puta historia.
Is that yours? Yes, you. Does that handbag belong to you?
Rose.
He is unbearable even at a distance.
I love that phrase, unbearable, even at a distance. At the beginning of that, you heard the sound of a barking dog, which during the course of the movie becomes absolutely incessant. And all the way through, there is this sense of everything boiling, simmering, just getting ready to all kind of blow over. I think the performances are really good. I think the performances are really well judged. They're understated. They're well played. The film itself is very ethereal and elusive. Now, apparently, if you have read the book, there are sections in the film in which the film is taking a punt at putting very complex ideas in the book on screen. And I know some people who've read the book who think that that doesn't particularly work. I haven't read the book. And having not read the book, I thought that what it did was created an atmosphere that I felt completely involved in. I mean, as I said, it's mysterious and elusive. It has an ending that has proved quite divisive, again, particularly for those familiar with the source novel, of which I'm not familiar. I mean, what I thought was, I went into it knowing nothing about it other than the title. And because I was kind of, because every time this happens, then you go, actually, why don't you just ask me, what does the title mean?
My guess is that hot milk is, I'm guessing here, because I think hot milk is revolting. It's sort of reassuring, isn't it, to start with?
Oh, warming, that's interesting.
So warming milk in, you know, you put it in hot chocolate or you know, cocoa, Bovril. Does anyone have Bovril? Not at this temperature, they don't. Anyway, but, you know, so at lower temperatures is calm and reassuring. But once it's hot, is not much. It's kind of spoiled. I don't know.
Is okay. Well, I think that that's actually very insightful, because I think, well, firstly, I think obviously when you think of milk, you think of mother's milk. And I think because there is a sort of, there is this central mother-daughter dynamic going on, I think that is part of it. Some of the atmosphere of the film is like, do you remember the Maggie Gyllenhaal film? I think you interviewed Maggie Gyllenhaal for it, The Lost Daughter. Or did you interview Olivia Colman?
No, it was Maggie.
Maggie Gyllenhaal. So there, I think there is a sort of similar kind of dynamic going on there. But I think that thing about, I think what hot milk is, it's like, it, you're right, it's the thing about the difference between warm and hot. Warm milk is reassuring, but hot milk is simmering and bubbling over and, you know, and implies that something is going sour, implies that something is going wrong. Yes. Anyway, all of these things are ideas that are in the film and I think are, you know, obviously the film takes its inspiration from, as I said, a novel that people very much respect. But as somebody who did not see, did not read the novel, just watched the film, I was really gripped by it. And I love the performances, particularly Fiona Shaw, I have to say. But I think all...
She's always great.
Yeah. I mean, like, literally, it's one of those things. It's like you see her in something, you think, okay, that's going to be fine. We're going to be fine. She's going to be great. And it's going to hold everything together. And it's going to be really, really good. And anyway, I very much enjoyed it. I think that comparison with The Lost Daughter is tonally helpful, because if you liked the tone of The Lost Daughter, I don't think this is quite as immediately easy to fall in with as The Lost Daughter is, but I think it's very, very well made, definitely demonstrates that she's not just a great writer, she's also a very, very good director, and three great performances, and the sound of the barking dog, which is like the sound of the fire under the stove, under the pot on which the milk is boiling.
Interesting. And I remember the Maggie Gyllenhaal interview, because I told her that I thought Peter Sarsgaard was hot in her film, which she was very pleased to hear, because they're married. So she said, I will enjoy telling him that. And then Peter came on the show a few months ago, and I told him that. And he seemed to be suitably chuffed, because he, although he's younger than us, he's at an age when to be told you're hot by anybody is a cool thing.
Yes, although if I tell you right now you're hot, I just mean you're sweltering and having to wear shorts.
I'm just wondering whether it's that kind of 1 o'clock in the morning trade-off. Do I have the window open and then hear everything that's going on outside, but we get cooler air, or to keep the window shut? So I could open the door to the rest of the house and then we hear what's going on in the rest of the house, but I'll be cooler. But then the audio quality will be less good. So I am, at the moment, I'm suffering for our art.
You're suffering for our ears.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you.
Because audio quality is the only thing that counts.
And always remember, I suffered for my art. Now it's your turn.
Box office top 10 this week. As I said, it's Monday. It's now 9:45. So we're recording this before the chart comes out. So we've guessed the top 10, which is, I think,
this is completely made up.
So, but I think this is great. Amadeus is at number one. I mean, I don't know how that happened. Anyway, but it's sort of, it's based on, this is the way a lot of radio stations back in the day did their chart. They've kind of made it up as they went along.
So here we go.
At number 10, Words of War.
Yeah, well, it well done for it going in for the top 10.
Has it?
I've got no idea. I've got no idea. Your interview is still available, and that was, I thought it was a really terrific interview. And it's a story that I'm ashamed to say I did not know better. And watching it made me want to go and find out more. And of course, it features in a supporting role, but in a very key role. Hello to Jason Isaacs.
Number 9, from the world of John Wick, Ballerina.
I enjoyed bits of it. I enjoyed watching some of the action sequences, and I enjoyed, Ana de Armas liked very much, Kenan Inu liked very much. It is a mess, but there it is.
The Salt Path is at number 8. So we
again
think.
Jason Isaacs now in the top 10 twice in this made-up chart.
Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, a colon and a hyphen at number 7.
First hour, second hour, ooh, third hour, wow!
Number 6, Lilo and Stitch, the and being an ampersand, which is my favourite piece of punctuation.
And did you explain to me why an ampersand is called an ampersand?
Yes, and it's and per se and of itself, and. And it's an ET, it's the letters ET in italics. That's how the construction appears.
There we go. And that's kind of more interesting than doing a live action.
Elio at 5.
Which I liked, apparently not generally liked, and certainly at 5 is it's not taking the charts by storm. But I thought it was very strange, and the plot is all over the place, and the narrative is quite hard to follow. But I did think, as I said before, I have never taken hallucinogenic drugs, but there were many moments watching Elio, and I thought, this probably what it's like.
How to Train Your Dragon is at 4.
If I had to choose between watching this and watching the original animation, it would just be it's a no-brainer. But obviously, you know, people are going to see, because How to Train Your Dragon is such a great story and the books that it's based on are great. So, of course, it's doing well. But I think if you'd reissued the cartoon, the animation in cinemas, it would have done justice. Or maybe not, I don't know.
28 years later, is it 3?
Well, you know, the conversation will continue. Yes. And the really great thing about it is, I mean, I really enjoyed it. So did you. Every day, every week since I see it, I have to reconsider what I think about the end. And I think that one of the most astute things was the email that we had last week.
In our spoiler section.
In our spoiler special, which I won't spoil it, which said, of course, in that world, no one ever knew. Which
about,
I think was a really good
everything.
Point. Yeah.
M3GAN 2.0 is at 2, confusingly.
Okay, may I say something, which is many people on our YouTube channel, which I'm very glad that people watching on YouTube, have been saying, why does he keep calling it M3GAN? It's pronounced Megan. It's not pronounced M3GAN. It's pronounced Megan. So let me explain something. It's written M3GAN in the same way as Fant Forstick. And if I find a joke ridiculously funny, I will keep doing it until the end of time. And the more you ask me not to do it, the more I will do it.
Although you did agree not to use silly names for actors.
Yes, because somebody said that's actually unfair.
Daniel in Clapham, I've just seen Megan 2.0. Thought the first was fine, but was a horror comedy lacking in scares and laughs. The second is less Chucky 2, more Terminator 2 meets Megan Impossible, which I quite like.
That's very good.
It gives up even pretending to be a horror franchise and goes for an action comedy adventure. It has a ludicrously over-the-top plot on a par with the last Mission Impossible film. It's almost Megan versus the Entity. But overall, despite a few laughs, it's only mildly entertaining, fair, again, and quite forgettable. Thank you, Daniel. And 1 is F1 the movie, F1: the movie. Ben Vost says the name, because we were talking, I think we called it Fuan.
Yeah, you were calling it Fuan, which I thought Ben was brilliant with the kind of Fuan.
Yes, okay, that makes it sound a little bit too raunchy. but Ben Vost says the name around here for F1 is Fur, mainly because it's written F1 and then it has the R with a circle, which is the sign for a registered trademark.
Okay.
So.
Of course.
So if it's F1 with an R, then that does indeed make it Fur. So
Fur.
Maybe that, yeah.
Very good. Let's call it that. That'd be good.
Dear Sterling and Juan Manuel, second time emailer, Rule Seabrand from Amsterdam writing in, F1 the movie, that was a good laugh. Nobody told me it was a comedy. This is Dutch comedy here. But seriously, folks, as an F1 fan.
Dutch comedy. It's no laughing matter.
For many years, with a rapidly waning interest, I just had to see it. My expectations were quite low, having read the premise beforehand, thinking, really? A washed-up old-timer racing car driver is paired with a rookie? How original. Surely there are screenwriters that can come up with something better than that. Apparently not. A 30-year hiatus, explaining a modern Formula One steering wheel in 1 minute. At some point, I really laughed out loud for some of the ludicrous plot twists presented in this pompous vehicle. Pun very much intended. And I really think they weren't going to go for the romantic angle, but spoiler alert, they did. I give it 2 stars, and one of those stars is a sympathy star for the action sequences. In my humble opinion, the movies Grand Prix and Le Mans remain the gold standard for executing a proper racing film. Kind regards and greetings from Amsterdam. Thank you, Rule.
Okay, so Fur/Fuan/ Grand Days of Top Thunder pre Rush Gun Maverick. Yes, not an original thought in its head. It's interesting when you talk about plot twists. No twists. I mean, I genuinely believe that you could show somebody the first 10 minutes of that film and go, tell me how the rest of the film goes, and they would absolutely do it. And I enjoyed it much more than I had thought I was going to, because Brad Pitt does that thing about turning up and being Brad Pitt. It is a recycled ragtag bag of bits of other films, but it's done with a great deal of elan, and it absolutely proves that Brad Pitt is Brad Pitt, movie star. And as I said last week, you know, Tom Cruise looks like he can't do enough to please you. And Brad Pitt just looks like, you know, and so as many people pointed out, as Shania Twain says, "So you're Brad Pitt." That does impress me.
Yep. Yep. Zoe Ball once called me an agent looking like an aging Brad Pitt, which I thought was only positive.
Yeah. I'd be considering, because Brad Pitt is now an aging Brad Pitt. And
himself.
If Zoe Ball thought you, yeah, somebody yeah. should say to Brad Pitt, "Brad Pitt, you look like an aging Brad Pitt."
Gaz Jacobs, just seen F1, the movie, at our local Odeon. The film shows a half-decent representation of the politics and rivalries within F1 teams. The racing footage isn't too bad either. Belief has to be suspended a couple of times, especially when they're trying to pass off Brands Hatch as the Spanish Jerez circuit, where Sonny has his Formula One career-ending accident. Footage of Northern Irish driver Martin Donnelly's real-life accident at the 1990 Spanish Grand Prix was used in the film. Martin received a thank you at the end. I know this because I've got this email has got footnotes.
Okay, wow.
And the fact that the character wouldn't have been black-flagged, another footnote, which means that you have to return to the pits. However, throughout the film, something was hanging around in the back of my head. During Mark's review of the film, he stated that as we meet Sonny Hayes, he's participating in low-rent races. "Really?" says Gaz. "Low rent? Now, whilst I do understand that most people are oblivious to any form of motor racing other than F1, when it comes to circuit racing races such as Rolex Daytona 24-hour and the Le Mans 24-hour, they are far from low rent. Millions of dollars and euros will be spent by manufacturers and private individuals trying to win these races. The prototype and GT racing provides a path to driving careers for talented drivers that just don't have the immense wealth or luck to be at the lofty heights of F1. I hope that some may see that footage and investigate further and discover a further world of motorsport where trackside tickets are less expensive." So thanks to Gaz Jacobs for his email. Sorry for mashing it all up, but he does talk later in the email. He does talk about F2, F3 and F4. So,
and yes, there are footnotes.
And there are lots and lots of, it's like a thesis, you know, with different numbers of stars for each one of them. But thank you for the work and effort, Gaz. I appreciate that. A star. If you're a Vanguard Easter, you don't get any ads. But if you are about to get the ads, what you need to know is that Mark is about to talk to David Cronenberg. Excite me for this interview. Mark.
David Cronenberg has made some of the films that have been the most important films in my life. Films like The Fly, Dead Ringers, Crash. I've been watching his movies since I was a teenager. I've been reading about his movies in Fangoria magazine since I was a teenager. And I have interviewed him a few times in the past, and he has never been anything less than one of the most intelligent filmmakers I have ever met.
Okay, so stand by for David Cronenberg. So our guest this week is the aforementioned David Cronenberg, icon of body horror, but a director with many talents and stories to tell. His latest film is The Shrouds. Mark spoke to him about it. You'll hear the conversation after this clip.
How dark are you willing to go?
I'm okay with dark.
When they lowered my dead wife into the ground in her coffin, I had an intense visceral urge to get into the box with her. It was so strong. I couldn't stand it that she was alone in there and that I would never know what was happening to her. It wasn't a literary or an intellectual thing. It was right here, pulling me hard.
That's a clip from The Shrouds. I'm very pleased to say that we're joined by David Cronenberg. David, welcome to the program. Firstly, congratulations on the film, which has haunted me since I saw it. The interesting thing is, at the center of it is a device, a shroud, that enables people who have lost loved ones to see the bodies of their loved ones decomposing in real time, which sounds like a very morbid idea, but our central character says, no, to me, I find it reassuring. And yeah. I wonder if you can say something about the fact that a film called The Shrouds, although it is about grief, is not simply about grief.
Well, I think a full-length feature film that's only about one emotion or one, let's say, human mode would be rather boring. Ultimately, it'd be like playing one note on the piano. So if you think, as I do, that it, you know, all the purpose of all art is to examine the human condition is quite complex and fluid and constantly changing. So I can't imagine only dealing with grief in a movie. I think that would be shortchanging the possibilities of your art. So it's sort of the emotional jumping off spot to explore all kinds of things, including, I mean, technology, the vagaries of human emotion, and, you know, the complexity of humor, the fact that I think we have evolved to have a sense of humor as a survival mechanism. A movie without humor is not fully human, as far as I'm concerned. That's why I think the movie is also fine. Different audiences I've found find it more or less funny. And I think part of it, you know, was the Cannes Film Festival audience is a very strange, unusual audience. There's subtitles. There are a couple of versions of subtitles. And of course, there's the glamour. Can we laugh at Cronenberg's movie? There he is sitting there in a tuxedo looking very serious. I mean, is it okay to laugh at his movie? And the answer is yes. And in fact, you must. So yeah, that's why a movie is a little universe and it has to have a lot of things in it to be a fully convincing, vibrant, alive universe.
That question about whether we're allowed to laugh is also put more acutely into focus by the fact that, as people will know, you made the film after losing your wife, and it was dealing with the issue of grief, which you were dealing with. And you've said very specifically, it's not catharsis. It's not to do with working through. It's just to do with using your life experience for your art. Is that how you feel about The Shrouds?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a school of thought that feels that art is, in basis, a therapeutic endeavor for humans. And I completely don't think that at all. It's more like play. It's like, well, why would you make a movie about the death of your wife if you weren't going to be grieving and sobbing and curled up in the fetal position all the time while you're on the film set? And the answer is that it's not an attempt to heal. It's an attempt to play with the events and facts of my life to create something that's different, that's alive, that's exploratory, and that does help me understand what life is, what it is like to be a human being on this planet at this time. And humor is a huge part of that. And if you want your characters to be completely alive, you have to have humor. They have to have, even if they are saying things that are funny that they don't realize are funny, but the audience does,
Yeah. Have
to count as humor. And I had to say, because of course the facts of my wife's death in 2017 are somewhat known, and that the movie is about that loss on a certain level. But as I've said many times, as soon as you start to write the screenplay, you're writing fiction. You are creating characters who don't really exist, but they insist on existing if you're lucky. And then they push you around and they start to say things that you didn't really expect them to say. And they start to do things you didn't really want them to do for your narrative. And you have to deal with that. But underneath that, it's very exciting because it means that they're alive. And at that point, then you are writing fiction. You are not writing autobiography. Of course, every work of art is autobiographical in the broadest sense because it comes out of your culture, out of your education, out of your mentality, out of your reading or your movie going, whatever it is. And so it's very unique to you. And it becomes, in that sense, always autobiographical. But on the more specific idea of this is almost a documentary, no, this is not that. This movie is not that.
You've always had a great relationship with actors. I remember when Jeremy Irons won his Oscar, basically saying that, you know, it was his work with you on Dead Ringers that had got him to that point. Several sort of very strong performances here, but at the centre, Vincent Cassel and Diane Kruger in not one, not two, but technically really three roles. And yet you have always said that you don't really rehearse with actors. Is that still true? Because the performances seem to be very confident.
Yeah, it's completely true. In fact, Diane was quite shocked when she came to the set because there was no scheduling of a rehearsal. And she had expected what is called in theater, and she was calling it a table read. Basically, you sit around the table with your actors and you read the script. They all read their lines and you discuss the dynamics and so on. And I told her, I said, you know, I tried that once on the fly and I found that it was completely useless because by the time we got to the real set with the real costumes and the space and everything, the dynamics of everything changed and everything that we had worked out in the rehearsal became completely irrelevant and useless. And I thought, therefore, I would never rehearse again. And I never did. But she would obviously had that experience and expected it. And I said, we'll go on the set in the morning and it'll just be me and you and the other actors and the cameraman and the script person. And that's it. Nobody else. And we will block the scene. We will find out how to move through the scene. And that is the first time I actually hear my lines of dialogue, if I've written them myself. The first time I've heard them spoken is when we're blocking the scene on the day that we're actually shooting it. And it's my feeling is that casting is it's a huge part of directing. And it's a very unexamined part of directing because it's not very glamorous. But I say to young filmmakers, casting is half the battle. I mean, you really have to be careful about who you cast in your movie. So I was saying to Diane, I trust your instinct, your intuition, that you will understand this character and you will start to understand how the dialogue should be delivered and so on. Now, I know that she and Vincent did a lot of work together, you know, doing line readings together, as actors usually do, partly to help them memorize the dialogue, but also to get the rhythms between them established and so on. But honestly, it worked really well. And for Diane, I mean, it's one or two takes. That's it. I don't have to do more. And same with all the other actors. They really understood the characters very deeply and it spent more time with them than I had. And they were great. And it was a very efficient, lovely shoot with lots of surprises for me as a director. And so I've never, once again, I have not yet encountered the need to rehearse. I was talking to Paul Schrader. We were at dinner together at the Toronto Film Festival, and he said to me, because he was talking to a couple of other people, rehearsal is everything. And I said, well, Paul, for me, rehearsal is nothing. It's worse than nothing. I think it's distraction. So, you know, that's it. You find your own way of working. And if he found it, he obviously has had success with his directing, and it works for him.
The other interesting collaboration that's longstanding for you is obviously with Howard Shore, your composer. And I recently wrote a book about film music and I interviewed Howard and he was very forthcoming talking about his relationship with you. And I asked him how he spoke to you about the films. He said, well, we talk about the themes. That's what we talk about. We don't talk about the story and the plot and the narrative and the thing. He said, we talk about the ideas. And I wondered whether, in a way, does talking to Howard about the ideas of the music, does it refine for you what the idea of the film is?
Oh, well, it definitely can. Yeah. I mean, even as much as talking to the production designer, Carol Spear, in this case, who I've worked with for almost half a century, believe it or not, will also force me to think in great detail about what's going on in the movie. And you expect that. You expect that from your costume designer and from your cameraman when you start to discuss lighting. And with Howard, it's a fairly abstract discussion, whereas with the cameraman, it's maybe not so abstract because music is very difficult to talk about in sort of concrete terms. For me, anyway, I'm not talking about, it'd be good to have an oboe here instead of a flute, you know. So we do talk about what we've always talked about, which is what is the music really doing in this movie? Why is it even there? Mm-hmm. And we consciously avoid having the music underscore exactly what is going on visually. Mm-hmm. So early on, we felt movie music tends to just underscore what is already there. So if it's a scary scene, you get scary music. If it's a romantic scene, you get romantic music, action scene, action music, and so on and so on. And we thought music could do something a lot more interesting. It could be an absolutely other plane of emotion or discourse. It could almost be like another character in the movie. And yes, I mean, all of my collaborations are help me understand the movie that I'm making. Another thing that I say to students is, you probably aren't going to be good at everything. You're not maybe going to be good at costumes and music and lighting and dialogue. And in that case, you accept that you have these crevices of non-intelligence and you will find really great people who can fill those crevices with their knowledge and experience and understanding. You need those collaborators. You want those collaborators. And they will all help you understand what the movie is that you're really making.
Are you working on another project now?
I had been working on a script that's based on my novel, Consumed, the one novel that I've written. Mm-hmm. Robert Lantos, Canadian producer, who worked with me many times before, really wants to make that movie. And I'm enthused by his enthusiasm. I wrote the movie, did the book in 2014 or 2011. I can't even remember. And I thought maybe it was no longer relevant to me, what I had written, because it was very much of the time that I was writing. But he did encourage me to reread my own novel, and he did encourage me to reread my old script for Crimes of the Future, which I had written 20 years before. And he seems to be very good at that. So I read my book, and I was surprising myself because I had forgotten a lot of things that were in there. And I thought, well, you know, this is actually not bad at all. you know, you have your doubts. And so if everything works out, I might be making a film of Consumed, my novel. It's very interesting to be adapting your own novel for the screen. There are many filmmakers who have done that. I've never done that. I have adapted the work of other wonderful writers like Burroughs and Don DeLillo and J.G. Ballard and so on. But to do your own, it's kind of a surreal, a meta type experience. So I'm looking forward to continuing that. And if the script turns out to be something that everybody feels is a viable project, then it might go ahead. I mean, it wouldn't be cheap. It would take place in four cities and had a rather large scope. And these days, for an independent film that would be basically an art film, that might be too much these days to finance. I have no idea. That would be for my producer really to explore and to conquer. You know, that's the art of the producer.
I'm aware that our 20 minutes is coming to an end. And I want to say, firstly, I really hope that you do make the film. The thing that's important to me is I started watching your films when I was a teenager, and I've spent most of my life watching your movies. And I've had conversations with people about, you know, what are they about? Well, they're about body horror, and they're about this, and they're about that, and blah, blah, blah. The thing I want to say to you is, and even when we're dealing with The Shrouds, which obviously is a film which is wrapped in the idea of grief, your films have made me really happy. And I really hope you keep doing it.
Well, that's probably the best review I've ever had. Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks very much.
Great to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
David Cronenberg speaking to Mark about his new movie. And you, because you are so immersed in his work, he clearly really appreciated what you said at the end there.
Well, it's funny. I was listening back to it. I hadn't realized quite how emotional I got about it. Because I do, you know, I have lived most of my life with his films. You know, he's in his 80s now, and he's the body of his work has been with me for most of my sort of film going life. And I love those movies. I absolutely love them. And I always remember, you know, very early on, you know, if you wanted to win an argument about horror, you just quoted David Cronenberg, because he was always, his films have always been about ideas, and that's what I love about them. And he was always the great, eloquent horror film director. He's kind of transcended genre very much now, because I think that although he came from horror, he's gone into many different areas with Maps of the Stars and Dead Ringers. But anyway, it was just lovely to speak to him, and you know, that was great.
But it was also what was interesting about it was that it was very insightful and wise, in as much also because you'd mentioned the fact his wife had died, and all the times that he was saying that it wasn't cathartic.
Yes.
I thought it definitely was. I haven't seen the film. I just listened to the interview. But when he talked about, I think the phrase he used was playing with the events of his life.
Yes.
That to me sounds like a sifting process from which you get understanding. And that to me sounds like catharsis. So I know he says that it's not, that absolutely is not what it was.
Yes.
It sounded to me as though, you know, what you said about just because you made the film doesn't mean that you understand it. I wonder if in the fullness of time, he will think that actually there was some therapy going on there. But catharsis is the right word.
I mean, in a way, this sort of leads me, you know, nicely into what I'd like to say in the review, which is that I think the act of making a film and watching a film is very different. And what you take from a film is one thing. And, you know, what you put into it is a different thing. So I cannot speak for Cronenberg and his experience. But what I can do is say that, you know, we prefaced that interview with that that little clip from the film in which the thing is, how dark are you willing to go? And on one level, this is very dark. I mean, the story is Vincent Cassel's car. She was a businessman behind Grave Tech Company, typically Cronenbergian company, who have developed this technology in which if, when someone dies, their body can be put in a shroud, that their loved ones are then able to watch those bodies decomposing, you know, because of the technology of the shroud. And Karsh has lost his wife. She is now part of the Grave Tech project. And he finds solace in watching the decomposition. He finds it reassuring, even though his doctor tells him at some point, grief is rotting your teeth. He's also close to his wife's identical sister, also played by Diane Kruger. And he has an AI assistant named Honey, who appears to be a third incarnation of that same character. That was the triple role that I was speaking of. And then there's a sort of plot, a narrative plot, which is that Grave Tech gets hacked, and we open up this whole sort of conspiracy thing. You know, who's hacked it? Why have they hacked it? What's the point of the hack? And there is this sort of strange mystery, which is that he is starting to notice that there are strange growths appearing on his wife's decomposing body. So now, look, that as made as a film made by somebody who has lost their wife and has expressed the grief of that is about as dark as you can get. And I think that when the film played at Cannes last year, some of the response from critics was bamboozled, because it was interesting in that interview, David Cronenberg said people didn't know if they were allowed to laugh at certain things. It was really interesting when he talked about comedy is really important because humor is part of a survival mechanism. And I love the fact that he said that, because that idea about horror and humor and grief and humor, all those things mixing, there is a survival mechanism. And he sort of said, we have evolved humor as a survival mechanism. So in terms of where this sits in Cronenberg's oeuvre, forgive me for using that word, but there is no other thing. He returns constantly to themes which have interested and obsessed him throughout his life. And those are themes of identity, of what it means to be human, of the divide between the body and is there a soul? Is there a different thing? Or are we simply part of the body? He's often talked about films like The Fly, which is really a film about aging. It's not a film about turning into a fly. It's a film about the body changing and the body mutating. You know, the Videodrome thing, Long Live the New Flesh. He is really, really fundamentally interested, fascinated by the human condition in which we are born and live in a body that then fails, or maybe failure is, you know, it then ceases and then goes into the next one. And that is what is going on here. Now, the previous film that he referred to, their Crimes of the Future, I felt like that was like kind of a rehashing of old ideas. It was just going back to old Cronenbergian riffs and rehashing them. I mean, the script had been around for a while, as he said. In the case of this, I think it's the opposite. I think it's reinventing those ideas. And I felt the thing that made me, and that was why I used that word at the end of the interview, made me happy, was I felt like it was creating new material, new life, new ideas, new things to think about. And, you know, as I said, all his films are, they're about ideas. And people used to, you know, oh, he's made films with exploding heads and he's made films with, you know, yeah, but that's not what they're about. Those are metaphors. Those things are metaphors. They are ideas made flesh. That's what he was doing. But they're just really a mechanism, a narrative mechanism to get you into a discussion of much, much deeper things. What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be dead? What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to miss somebody's physical presence? So I thought it was strange and elegiac and occasionally absurd, deliberately so. People may laugh at it or with it, or they may roll their eyes, or they may do as some did in Cannes and just not get it. But I've seen it a couple of times now, and I think it takes a crushing experience of loss and uses it as a starting point for a film which is actually ultimately uplifting and is proof that, you know, even at this advanced stage of his life, Cronenberg is as lively and as nimble with his ideas as he ever was. And can I also just say, as you heard him talking in that interview, there is a man that talks in whole sentences.
Mm-hmm.
I love his films, and I'm a big fan of The Shrouds, and I definitely hope that the new film happens.
Your favorite David Cronenberg films discussed in our One Frame Back feature, which is in Take Two for subscribers. And if, as David and Mark have said, humor is a survival mechanism, we have reached the last 30 seconds of our existence. Because this is, in inverted commas, a laughter lift.
Oh, dear.
Hey, Mark, do you remember when we both worked at Radio 1?
Yes.
There was that really irritating boss who kept interfering with things, getting on our nerves all the time, and he got really annoyed when I shortened his name to Dick, especially as his name was actually Stephen. Okay, but it's kind of okay. Mark, some bad news. I'm afraid I've been ejected from the Showbiz North London Vietnamese Sandwich Club.
Oh, no.
Which is infuriating. I've absolutely no idea what I did to make them ban me. Which is a good written joke.
Hey,
but
I get
set
it.
Set out. Okay. Anyway, I see it's Jurassic World Rebirth next, Mark, which reminds me, did you see the news this morning? A fossilized dinosaur fart has been discovered.
No.
It's a real blast from the past. And I have to say that's got a much better reaction than I was expecting. But Mark, sell me on your review of the last film that you're going to be reviewing today.
I'm going to be reviewing Jurassic World Rebirth. Hey, dinosaurs are back.
Okay, I consider myself animated and excited. That's on the way. So before we get to dinosaur business, here's some swimming trunk business from Greg in Southwark.
Okay.
Not a French swimming pool anecdote, but the recent chat put me in mind of an old school friend who was on a German exchange aged 14 to the delightful town of Lübeck in a very hot June sometime in the 1980s.
Yes.
On the Saturday, his host family decided to take the young lad, let's call him Luke because that's his name, to the delightful seaside resort of Travemünde, a short drive from their home. He packed a small bag, popped his very 80s, very bijou trunks on under his shorts, grabbed a towel and a novel, and off they went. At lunchtime, the German host said that they were off to get something to eat, and would he like to come? Yes, please, says Luke, imagining that a delicious beachside currywurst und Brötchen, were on the cards. Without a second thought, he jumped up from his towel and followed along, still wearing the aforementioned snug-fitting Speedos and nothing else, because he thought he was getting some beach food.
Yeah.
It was only when they passed the beachside fast food stalls that Luke realized that perhaps he might be a tad underdressed. And when the beach resort town stopped really being beach resort town and just becoming a town, then the awful reality descended upon him. They had to pop into a supermarket first, as Mutter needed to pick up a few things, and then onward they went to their favorite Bavarian restaurant. The Germans attired in shirts, shorts, and shoes, and young Luke in his trunks. No one said a word as they sat down and ate what must have been the most awkward and slightly surreal meals the proprietors had ever witnessed. Needless to say, young Luke is still pretty much traumatized by this event, which he describes as literally a nightmare.
Yes.
And he hasn't been back to Germany since.
Literally.
It does sound like I had a terrible dream last night. I dreamt that we went to the local curry house and I was only wearing my pants. That's what happened to Luke back in the 1980s.
It's just not right.
No, but he didn't realize.
No.
Poor lad.
But then, you know, so nobody should wear Speedos.
Yeah, ever. I think it's the grown-up's fault for saying, no, I think you need to just pop on a T-shirt or something like that. Anyway, Greg, thank you. Correspondence at conamare.com. Dinosaurs are back. Take it away.
Jurassic World Rebirth, 12A for moderate threat, violence, and language. This is the sequel to Jurassic World Dominion, the fourth Jurassic World film, the seventh Jurassic movie. Stars Scarlett Johansson, Mahershala Ali, Jonathan Bailey, Rupert Friend, Manuel Garcia, Ed Skrein, loads of people. Script by David Koepp, spelt Koepp, but pronounced Koepp apparently, who co-wrote the original Jurassic and did Lost World. Directed by our friend Gareth Edwards, who made the micro-budget monsters pretty much in his bedroom, did all those special effects in his bedroom after having sort of shot the film Verite style. Did a very good job, I thought, with the mega-budget Godzilla.
Rogue One.
Kicked around town with Rogue One, but I still quite like the film.
Yes.
Made the creator. Now, we interviewed him for the creator, didn't we?
We did indeed. Yeah.
I think that was a very interesting film. It was big budget science fiction movie. Very interesting. So there's been a lot of stuff about how he wasn't the first choice for Jurassic World Rebirth, but was considered a safe pair of hands, not least because he's proved himself so incredibly adept at mixing visual effects with live action footage, almost sort of, as I said, almost verite down to earth live action. So after Dominion, which was the very definition of ho and indeed hum, this is a rebirth in inverted commas, new characters. Doesn't include previous characters from the sequels. New setup, new storyline, plays out in a world in which dinosaurs are dying out and no one cares anymore. There's an early scene which has these commuters who are annoyed. They're in a city and they're annoyed because a dinosaur has escaped from a zoo. And what they're annoyed about is that it's holding up the traffic as it's dying. No one cares about dinosaurs. The only place that dinosaurs are still thriving, because they've all sort of fallen apart, is this equatorial area where the climate and ecosystem is good for them. And the area is strictly banned for all visitors for obvious reasons, because every time you put humans and dinosaurs together, bad things happen. So the script has to contrive a reason to send a bunch of people to go into this banned area. The reason is a company has figured out that it can make a cure for heart disease if it manages to get blood samples from three different dinosaurs, one waterborne, one land-based, one airborne. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's the setup. So Scarlett Johansson is this kind of badass who's making a fortune putting the mission together. They got a dino specialist who wants the world to benefit from his discoveries rather than the pharma companies. Then you've got adventurers and sort of mercenary types. What are we missing? Oh, we're missing a family. So en route to this area that they're not allowed to go to, they pick up a shipwrecked family, including an annoying boyfriend who just happened to be in the area. Yeah, right. So what they have to do is they have to get the blood by shooting a hypodermic syringe into each of these, waterborne, airborne, landborne. The hypodermic then, after it's got the blood, shoots out a capsule that then produces a parachute and then parachutes down with the blood sample, often happening, coming right into their hands. They must do this on land, on sea and in the sky, whilst every now and then making quips like, well, that just happened. Here's a clip from the trailer.
On the island we're headed to, 24 species have survived there alone.
The theme park owners did experimental work, leaving only the worst ones here.
See that every day
or ever.
So you see what I mean about stuff happens, then you don't see that every day, you don't see it ever. Maybe we should make this quick, blah blah. Now, two things. Firstly, I saw this at a premiere screening in which the audience went nuts. They cheered, they laughed, they whooped, they did the whole thing. And I say that because I think that I need to have that up front, because I didn't do any of those things. So the first film, it's so hard to think back to this, but do you remember the first time you saw Jurassic Park?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. First time we saw it, it actually gave us the impression of walking with dinosaurs. It was like, wow. However, in the world in which this film is set, the world has become completely bored with the thing about dinosaurs. And honestly, I think as audiences, so have we. And so have the filmmakers, to the point that it's not just dinosaurs now, it's mutated dinosaurs. It's the Distortus Rex, which incidentally, the reveal of which has already been spoiled by the publicity. So for a film which says it's a new start, new characters, new storyline, and is called Rebirth, it's strange how much of this, just the overriding sense is we have seen all of this before, but crucially, we cared about it more. So all the usual beats are there, the big dinosaurs, ensemble cast of misfit characters, sinister corporations doing sinister corporation-y stuff, people getting picked off by the dinosaurs, which were rides but aren't rides anymore. What there isn't is, firstly, any of the memorable dialogue of the first film. You remember the first film, all the stuff about chaos theory. You remember all the brilliant stuff about, you know, your scientists were so busy wondering whether they could. They never stopped to wonder if they should. All that stuff. Clever girl. All those brilliant things. Nothing like that here. Instead, the characters are paper thin. The plotting is, I mean, when they explained the mission, it was like, oh, come on, that is just Thunderbirds. The shipwrecked family, the computer game goals, even the sort of big pharma is baddie stuff, it all just felt like, okay, yeah, and the next beat, and the next beat, and the next plot. And then the dinosaurs, which are now basically just big screen roaring monsters. The only potential surprise being the reveal of the stuff which we've kind of already seen. I read a thing in which the scriptwriter said that what he wanted to do was get back to the tone of the original Jurassic movies. It doesn't. What it does is remind us how much more, particularly the first movie, how much more exciting it was the first time, and how the sense of awe that we got the first time, you know, all those reaction shots, which are people looking up and suddenly seeing like a whole field full of dinosaurs, or the dinosaur in the tree, or the first time that the T-Rex eye, and all that stuff, it's gone. Now, on the upside, it's better than the last installment, which isn't saying that much. And Gareth Edwards is a very, very good director who proves himself very capable. And I think he gets the very best out of what is honestly a shonky script. But compare that to what he did with Creator. You liked Creator, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I did, yes.
And it had loads of interesting things in it. It didn't all work, but it had loads of interesting things, and some things that you hadn't seen before, and some ideas that you didn't expect. And it was adventurous, and it went to strange places. This feels like, do you remember there's a thing in, it's one of the early films in which there's like dinosaur fast food. You know, they're at the theme park, so there's dinosaur-themed fast food. And this basically reminded me of that, you know, the kind of the processed, samey, hugely saleable, utterly forgettable. It's like the Big Mac of Jurassic movies. And it, you know, if F1 is a bucket of popcorn movie, then this is basically a Big Mac with fries movie. And it was funny because I was watching it and I was thinking, I don't know whether you remember, there was a film of Fast Food Nation in which Bruce Willis does this thing about, you know, about processed burgers. And he says, yeah, you know, it's a sad fact of life, but, you know, if you're going to eat processed burgers, the truth is we all have to eat a little from time to time. And I did think, watching this, it's going down well with the crowd. I can hear it. They are literally whooping and cheering. And when stuff happens and missions, they are all, bear in mind, it's a premiere crowd. So many of them are just excited to be there. But it was clearly playing well with them. It will clearly take a ton of money. It is better than the last installment. Edwards has done a really, really good job with a very shonky script. And at no point was I interested at all.
The last Jurassic film I saw, I remember, because we discussed it, being almost embarrassed about how poor the CGI was.
Oh, yeah.
And it was quite early on, and there was a chase scene. I thought, that's the one thing that you have to get right. You know, even if the script is terrible, if I don't believe the dinosaurs, there really is no point in coming to this film. Yes,
that wasn't the case with this.
Okay,
and that's part good. Of the reason with that is I do think that Gareth Edwards knows how to do visual effects in, you know, VFX in real world settings that look real. That is one of his great talents. And I think he's the star of this show because I think he's directed it as well as it is possible to direct that script.
It's the end of take one. This has been a Sony Music Entertainment production. This week's team, Jen, Eric, Josh, Heather. Producer, Jem. Redactor, Simon Paul. If you're not following the pod already, please do so because it's kind of rude to have got to this point and you're not even following us. Mark, what is your film of the week?
Well, I'm delighted to say my film of the week is The Shrouds. And I'm also delighted that Cronenberg was talking about making the next film. You know, long may he continue. Long live the new flesh.
Take two has landed adjacent to this very entertaining podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you very soon.